Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 183 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Three cases again today, and they all relate to insurance, not intentionally, but that's how it worked out. First case today is from the Seventh Circuit, Great American versus State Farm. The second is from the Seventh Circuit. Well, that was Great American versus State Farm, right? And first was Attain Specialty Insurance Company versus Bailey. Apologize, my notes are scrambled. And the third is from the Indiana Supreme Court, another long title that sometimes we see in Indiana, Safeco Insurance Company of Indiana, also subrogee of Ramona Smith versus Blue Sky Innovation Group, Inc., Cabela's Wholesale, LLC, TMBC, LLC of Missouri, Bass Pro Outdoor World, LLC, Cabela's Retail of Missouri, LLC, Bass Pro, LLC, Bass Pro Group, LLC, and Michaelis Corporation. Turning to our first case.
And it's that last defendant that's the object of their ire.
Right. For sure.
Michaelis is the real problem. That's the folks they're unhappy with.
Right. Right. So turning to our first case, in a case that has shades of Elmore versus State Farm from the Illinois Supreme Court, which concerned a mechanical device exclusion and a personal lines policy, the Seventh Circuit recently heard argument in the Attain Specialty Insurance Company versus Watson concerning the exception to an auto exclusion in the CGL policy. The underlying plaintiff was injured when her boyfriend was driving a truck insured under the policy while pulling a wood chipper. A nearly $7 million judgment was obtained against the underlying defendant, and the plaintiff sought to garnish the policy. The exception to the auto exclusion provided as follows. This exclusion does not apply to Section 5, bodily injury or property damage arising out of A, the operation of machinery or equipment that is attached to or part of a land vehicle that would qualify under the definition of mobile equipment if it were not subject to a compulsory or financial responsibility law or other motor vehicle insurance law in the state where it is licensed or principally garaged, end quote. The district ruled in favor of the insurer and the underlying plaintiff appealed. Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. And this is one of those cases where we have to dig deep into what does this mean? We have the, what does this exclusion mean? What does this policy mean? An exception to an exclusion, something only an insurance lawyer could love. So there's an exclusion as is the usual situation in a CGL policy for automobiles. You have typically, you either have a package policy that's for a business operations, what's called a BOP policy that will cover, business property, the physical building. We've talked about a lot of that in the BI stuff in COVID. And then you'll have a section of the policy that may involve EPLI, employer's liability coverage. You may have a section that deals with cyber. You have a section that deals with commercial general liability, what used to be called comprehensive general liability. You have that, and then you have a commercial auto policy, if that's the kind, if that business has commercial auto. But almost always, the CGL portion has an auto exclusion in it that says we are not covering anything to do with an automobile. You go get separate coverage for that. That's a different risk. Automobiles are their own thing. You go get some other coverage for that. And sometimes in that commercial auto coverage could take the form of if you're dealing with a company that delivers pizzas, say, and they've got their pizza business and they've got all those coverages I just mentioned, and then they've got guys driving around delivering pizzas and they need to have a separate policy for that, so they'll have a commercial auto policy. It might be a trucking company, similar situation. They've got a fixed facility where the trucks come in, what have you, where they store things and so forth. They repair the vehicles perhaps. And they've got the usual policies, and then they've got a commercial auto policy that deals with not only liability with respect to those vehicles, but also should those vehicles be damaged and things of this kind. Because again, automobile risks are underwritten differently than other risks. And if we can think about it, we think about, I would liken it to the Fourth Amendment, a strange analogy, but I think it fits. And that is this: why is there the automobile exception? Because the car could move. It could go on its way. The house can't move. I remember years ago when I was a public defender, the lawyer I was working under who was supervising me when I was a CLI, I was a Florida calls them CLIs, Illinois, we call them 7-Elevens. I was working in that, the public defender's office. And I remember one time my supervising attorney, I think she stood on the table and she said, "Keep your drugs at home. They can't get in your house. They could get in your car." And they can. And it may depend upon different parts. Or if you're going to put it in your car, put it in the trunk. I have a hard time getting into the trunk. Or put it in a case inside the car. It's harder to get into. But better yet, leave it at home. They can't get in your house. Similar idea. The house, the car are different for the purposes of where the police can go look. The house, the car, or the building, the car, automobile, what have you, are different depending on how you insure them, because they're different. Cars are different things. They move around. And this particular thing that moves around, there's an exception. If it's got mobile equipment attached, there's an exception to the exclusion. So if the mobile equipment causes the injury. So when I read this and I saw Woodchip, oh God, Fargo?
That's what I was thinking.
Please no. Please. Were you thinking the same thing?
I was. Yeah.
Please no. Because in the Elmore case, the device was attached. It was a corn lift or whatever, and it traumatically amputated this guy's leg, and it's terrible. But there was an exclusion for mechanical equipment attached to the car because the truck was running and it was driving. I'm drawing a blank on it. It's a corkscrew device. What's the thing called, Dan? I should know. I live in Illinois. And auger. It was a grain auger. That's what it was.
Yep.
And so it was attached to the vehicle. Sorry. My apologies. I've lived in Illinois long enough. I should know what a grain auger is. So that's what this thing was. So, and that was in Elmore. And the court held, no, that's not covered. That thing is not covered. So the question here is there's a general auto exclusion in this policy. And then here, the exception is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, the operation of machinery or equipment that is attached to. Well, in this case, the wood chipper was just attached. It wasn't being used.
Right.
No Fargo here, people. Not that's not what happened. What happened was he's just driving around and it happens to have a piece of a mechanical equipment attached. That doesn't mean that the mechanical equipment was the bodily injury or property which arising out of the operation of machinery or equipment that is attached to. It was just attached. It wasn't, the injury didn't arise out of the fact that there was a wood chipper attached. Now, I will give the plaintiff's lawyer kudos for effort. He's got this, obviously there's a catastrophic injury. I don't know the nature of the injuries, but presumably they're catastrophic to warrant a $7 million judgment, whether it was default or otherwise. And now he's trying to collect on it. So I get it. And you go where you can get it and you try to make the arguments you can, because $7 million is a lot of money. Even now, $7 million is a lot of money. He could retire on that,
yeah,
or his fee out of that. But I don't think he's going to get it out of this, Dan. I think the district court, Judge Gilbert down in the Southern Illinois, held that there was no coverage. It didn't seem to me in listening to the oral argument that the Seventh Circuit panel was buying what the plaintiff was selling, notwithstanding the sympathy of the situation and the nature of the injuries. But we'll see. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat, and I think that we've done other cases too. We had the roof loader that was attached to the truck, that case, and these come up a lot. And as we've talked about in this show, I mean, the CGL policy is for, you know, comprehensive, or, you know, like you said, now it's commercial, but it used to be comprehensive, and they got rid of comprehensive because comprehensive sounds like it covers everything. And as we've talked about in this show,
doesn't.
You know, the the insuring agreement's one paragraph, two paragraphs, and then there's all kinds of exclusions, conditions, and other things that, and again, it's for commercial injuries. It's not for the reason vehicles are on. As you said, it's different underwriting. It's a different, you need the auto insurance. So that's just part of it. And it's, you know, it's interesting because in these cases, you know, like you said, you give credit to the plaintiff here and the attorney trying to find pockets of money. I had lunch with Kim Levinson last week and we were talking about, you know, sometimes you have cases where there's not a lot of money available, you know, and could be an egregious injury and you do your best to find pockets of money to address the injury. But, you know, it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, there's three parts to taking a case for a plaintiff's lawyer: nature of injury, liability, and anyone would be able to pay this.
Right.
And it's that third one that's often difficult. And it's always amazed me how few plaintiff's lawyers pay attention to the coverage. That is how they're getting paid.
Right.
Because they get paid most often by insurance companies. They might want to know something about coverage. And how many of them don't know the first thing about coverage when these are the people that are paying you. Sometimes willingly, sometimes not so much. So you might want to know something about that. And Ken's one that I know knows about those things. He's got to be able to figure out where there's coverage.
And again, you know, you see this a lot of times, you know, again, I don't know what the catastrophic injury here is either. Like I said, like you said, when I saw a wood chipper, I thought, oh my God, did something bad happen? But no, you know, the
something different bad happened.
Yeah. But you know, a lot of these large verdicts and we never really find out what the actual payment is because again, you know, I mean, the plaintiff's firms like in Chicago, we both know folks that are at those firms and do well and they settle a lot of cases. There's some verdicts but we don't ever see what they actually get in the door. So, and a lot of the settlements are confidential. And so that's, I think in this case, like you said, I think it's going to be tough to find that this somehow comes under this policy just because he had a wood chipper attached to his truck.
Yep. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with another insurance coverage case, Great American versus State Farm. People always take joy when two insurance companies are fighting it out. Yep. That's what happened here.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 183 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. The appellant Great American and Great American Insurance Company versus State Farm Fire and Casualty framed the questions presented to the Seventh Circuit as follows. Whether the risk pool had a duty to defend where the risk pool's coverage agreement explicitly provides indemnity-only coverage. Even though that indemnity-only coverage involves defense costs at the close of the case. That's my commentary. The risk pool advanced defense cost against its ultimate indemnity obligation, which the contract provides, is determined only after the board member's liability has been fixed through a judgment or settlement. The risk pool advanced defense cost on a discretionary basis, not pursuant to any contractual undertaking. Assuming the risk pool had no duty to defend, whether the umbrella insurer had a duty to defend where the umbrella policy's defense provision either contains an express duty to defend or is ambiguous. The umbrella insurer admits that the former president's complaint alleged at least one potentially covered theory of liability. The umbrella policy's other insurance clause was not triggered because the risk pool did not have a duty to defend at all, much less a concurrent duty to defend. 3, assuming the umbrella insurer had a duty to defend, whether the umbrella insurer is a stop from raising its coverage defenses where at no point in the 7-year underlying litigation did the umbrella insurer participate in or contribute to its insured's defense. At no point in the 7-year underlying litigation did the umbrella insurer file a declaratory judgment action seeking to validate its coverage position. State Farm, in contrast, framed the issues as follows. Whether the district court correctly held on a motion for judgment on the pleadings, that State Farm did not owe a duty to defend Hamilton in an underlying suit where the relevant loss was potentially covered and later was ultimately covered by another insurance policy. Whether the district court correctly held that the estoppel doctrine does not apply here because State Farm did not owe a duty to defend. The State Farm policy provides as follows. If a suit is brought against any insured for damages because of a loss to which this policy applies, we will provide a defense to the insured at our expense when the basis for the suit is a loss that is not covered by any other policy, but is covered by this policy. Dan, tell us about this case, which arises out of the president of the DuPage County, the College of DuPage's president being fired.
Right. And we've done other cases with faculty. And
I'm sorry, not her being fired, but decisions she made firing involved with paying someone else. Sorry.
Right. And it involves directors and officers policies and again, this umbrella policy. Pat, we've talked a lot about on this show over the last 3 years. I think this is end of our third year, right? 2021 we started on the January 1st.
We're going into season four. Next episode will be season four.
And we've talked a lot about other insurance provisions and how they operate. This is a little bit different, but it's in this case, as you read, a lot of these policies for directors and officers especially, not always, but some of the policies are set up so that they're, as you mentioned, indemnity, but they cover defense costs if there's a final judgment or settlement. And so it gets a bit confusing because the standard we always talk about in insurance law is a duty to defend versus duty to indemnify. Here, the duty to defend, there is no duty to defend ongoing, but it's an indemnification of defense costs if there is final coverage and the policy applies. At the beginning of this, Pat, one of the panelists was Judge Robner. She lives remote and has since COVID began. And at the beginning, when she was brought on, they welcomed her after about 33 seconds of blank tape. And then she said, "Sorry, my head is getting cut off." And she was told,
well, that was Judge Sykes. Judge Sykes' head was getting cut
and
off.
She's, and they talked about how she's still beautiful, even with her head being cut off. So it was a funny moment. But the humor ended as soon as the appellant lawyer started talking and making some of her arguments. She said that this was a story of a compare and contrast. She talked about how Consortium and State Farm, two different products, two different animals, and that the district court went wrong. And Judge Robner and Judge Sykes were both asking a lot of questions about and setting forth some of these principles I just mentioned, the duty to defend. And one of the things that I think with this advocate that we talked about, Pat, in getting ready for this taping, is that the advocate, let's just say, was very she reminded me a little bit of Lisa Blatt, but not as much the ability to kind of deflect. She, at a couple times, said that the hypotheticals or where the lines that Judge Sykes and Judge Robner were using were not appropriate or not in keeping with actual law or whatever. I forget her exact phrases at times. I try to capture some of them in my notes. She, at one time, right before she ended, she said it's apparent that we're disconnecting and not connecting. And when she got up in rebuttal, it didn't come very much better. When the State Farm attorney came up, again, you read the language of the State Farm policy, and it talks about if there's the potential or actual coverage. And their argument was, look, there was another policy out there that potentially called, and State Farm's policy, you have to read its duty to defend in light of what the language of our policy says, because that's how this works. And if you read our policy, it's very clear that our duty is not triggered if there's some other policy that potentially will cover the defense costs, and that's what we're really talking about here. One of the wrinkles in this case, I think, Pat, that's again not clear why they did it, but Great American, the appellant here, they advanced defense costs even though their policy says that they don't pay anything until the end, until final judgment is done. We could presume some ideas of why they may have advanced costs. Sometimes in these cases, obviously they get very expensive depending on the litigation, and some of the named directors or officers under these policies might not have the wherewithal to front substantial defense costs. And, you know, you don't want to take a default on these cases and you want to protect your rights, but we don't know for sure why they advanced.
I think it probably has more to do with the fact it's a consortium.
Yeah.
And that it's not exactly insurance.
Yeah.
It's more a risk pool situation.
Yeah.
And not unlike a mutual company like ISBA Mutual or ISME. So the primary or one of the principal lawyers, insurer of lawyers in Illinois, and the principal insurer of individual doctors in Illinois, they're mutuals.
Yeah.
That is that their boards are made up of their members, lawyers, doctors, former presidents of both organizations. And these are their insureds, the ones that are getting sued are their friends, their colleagues.
Yeah.
And a similar situation in risk pool where you're dealing with public entities, you know, but I think all of them are like, but for the grace of God, go I, how are we going to make this work in our budget?
Yeah.
Let's front this to make this go a little easier. And so it's a much different kind of arrangement when you're a true risk pool or a true mutual like that.
And
some companies call themselves mutuals and aren't. These are real mutuals.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so it's not, these risk pools are not exactly pools or not exactly mutuals, but yeah, they're, I do some work for some of these regulatory municipal pools. And as you mentioned, the people that are on the boards are made up of the various either agencies that are under this consortium or they're just workers and, you know, they're, like you said, they're but for the grace of God. And so it's a bit of a different policy. But in any event, that was one of the things that happened here. One of the questions from Judge Rovner was probing whether the position of the appellant was that they never have to pay defense costs. And the appellant said no, if there's an obligation, if covered. But there's never a duty to defend, that State Farm has a contractual duty to defend. And again, this the way the policy of Great American is set up, it's triggered only if there's final judgment or settlement. So, based on the arguments, I think the appellant's going to have a hard time here getting this thing reversed. But interesting case.
Very interesting indeed, and we'll see how this comes together. But it's a how these policies don't exactly fit together very nicely. But again, this is Chief Judge Sykes was principally focused on is the State Farm policy is a true excess policy, and there is no underlying because this was a personal policy. This was there were several directors that had been sued in this litigation, and only one of these folks had a personal policy that might potentially provide coverage, and it was the State Farm policy. But it was a true excess, and so it rarely would drop down, and would not drop down if there was other coverage. And so the question was there other coverage? And Chief Judge Sykes, you kept using this term that a gloss on every policy is potential coverage. It was potentially covered under the consortium's policy, even if it was an indemnity only policy and that duty didn't arise, there was a gloss on it that it was potentially covered and therefore the duties arose. That was where she was coming from and where the lawyer for the consortium was having a very difficult time.
Yep.
So with that, we will take our next break and come back with Safeco versus Michelis, which yeah, it's captioned like an insurance case, but it's not really an insurance case. But we'll call it an insurance case.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiuminpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podiumin Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 183 of the Podiumin Panel Podcast. Will the Indiana Supreme Court recognize a third-party spoliation cause of action, or will the court give the plaintiff the opportunity to replead? If the court does recognize the tort, will it be of the case within a case variety, where the plaintiff has to prove all the elements, or will it be more forgiving and allow the plaintiff to avoid having to prove causation? Those are among the questions to be addressed when the Indiana Supreme Court decides Safeco Insurance Company of Indiana as subrogee of Ramona Smith versus Blue Sky Innovation Group, Inc. The court described the case thusly, quote, a house insured by Safeco Insurance Company of Indiana caught fire in October 2019. Safeco determined the fire resulted from a food dehydrator in the home's kitchen. Michaelis Corporation performed restoration work and was informed of the need to preserve the kitchen and dehydrator. Even so, Michaelis demolished the kitchen and discarded the dehydrator. Safeco filed negligence and third-party spoliation claims in Marion Superior Court. Michaelis moved to dismiss both claims, and the trial court granted the motion. The Court of Appeals reversed, finding Safeco's allegations were sufficient to survive a trial rule 12b6 motion. Safeco Insurance Company of Indiana versus Blue Sky Innovation Group, Inc., 211 Northeast 3rd, 564, Indiana Court of Appeals, 2023, vacated. The Supreme Court has granted Michaelis' petition to transfer and assume jurisdiction over the case, end quote. Pat, tell us about this interesting case that we covered at the appellate level.
Thanks, Dan. And just as a reminder, where in Indiana, where the Indiana Supreme Court grants transfer, the appellate court decision is vacated and the parties go back to the positions they were in after they left the trial court. So that's why Safeco is the appellant here, even though they won a reversal on appeal. So they go back to having the position of having lost because the appellate court decision is vacated. So that's why we find ourselves in this situation. And let's just say, their position as having lost didn't improve at the oral argument. The justices were very skeptical of the idea of how, under any rubric, Safeco was going to be able to prove their case. That is, okay, the device is destroyed. Now, what do you have? How are you going without it? How are you going to show that the device was, or if it had been present, how are you going to show that one of the other defendants would have won, or we would be able to get a claim against them had it not been destroyed? It's the problem with nearly any spoliation claim, and no different here. The plaintiff is going to have, as I said, a very difficult time trying to prove this case. Even if the court recognizes this cause of action, and if they recognized it, what that cause of action would look like.
Yep.
Illinois is among the states that it is not a separate cause of action. It's just a species of negligence. It's not a standalone claim. There are apparently a group of states, a small group of states, where it is a separate cause of action for spoliation. And the question becomes, is it a case within the case where they have to prove it that way, or is there some sort of reduced level of proof on the causation element to prove it? And the other problem here is that did Michaelis have this duty in the first place? So there's an issue regarding duty. And what do they have to, or whether they had sufficient information or were instructed, there was no contract that told them what they had to do. There was, you know, they thought that this is what happens when you assume things. Someone assumed something that it was going to be preserved. It wasn't. And now you have this problem. If the device had been preserved, then obviously this is a different kettle of fish. Michaelis isn't in the case at all. And then they can figure out if it's a design defect, a manufacturing defect, some other cause, but the whole kitchen's gone and the person's got the new kitchen. And this has to be balanced against, you heard some of these concerns from the court, against getting the kitchen repaired.
Yep.
Because, you know, having, you know, how long do you have to give to repair these things? I recently had a fire case down in Indiana. It was a bar, fire in a bar, and some adjacent units were damaged as well. One with common ownership or similar ownership to the bar. And, you know, you got to get this thing moving along so they can get back to business, so they can rehab the bar, so they can, you know, do whatever. And so there was some pressure to move things along because you're causing injury to others when you don't get the inspection done quickly enough, and there's ongoing damages. So same kind of idea. You want to get these things resolved. And so depending upon how they craft this, if they do, I'm not sure they're going to, depending on how they craft this, they have to balance that as to how do you get restoration done, because this is usually done in the subrogation context or where there's damage to the property. You know, counsel for Safeco framed this as we are entitled to some remedy here. I don't know if it's against Michaelis. I don't know if it's against the product manufacturers or the retailers. We're entitled to something. Either give us the opportunity to go back and replead, give us a cause of action, give us something, but don't have us standing here with no opportunity to recover at all. That's not fair. We've been wronged. We're entitled to some measure of recovery. A strange argument to hear from an insurance lawyer, but I certainly understand her point that, you know, they're innocent here. It seems that there are other steps that could have been taken, and had they been taken, the duty element at least would have been clear. But I don't know if it would have solved the causation problem that they've got. They have a causation problem in this case no matter what. And I don't know how they get around that. No matter how they plead it, no matter how the court conceives of the cause of action, if they do conceive of a cause of action, I don't know how they get around the cause. There has to be some causation. Because you have to be able to prove what would have happened if the device had been preserved. And in the absence of that, I don't know how you do that. I've defended spoliation cases before. It was a bit of a specialty I had for a little while. We had a bunch of them and I kept getting them. And one on the statute of limitations, I've probably told this story before, where the Judge Doherty, now Justice Doherty, laughed at me at my argument on what the statute of limitations should be, and then granted my motion on duty. And then when we went to the appellate court, the court granted, affirmed on the statute of limitations, didn't reach the issue of duty. So it was a very satisfying day. I won either way. It didn't matter. I had all kinds of arguments. But there's now a split in the circuits, or districts rather, between what the statute of limitations is that still hasn't been resolved. But in any event, these are difficult cases for plaintiffs to prevail on. There's lots of hurdles over duty and lots of hurdles over causation. And in my case, also issues over statute of limitations. That wasn't an issue here. But you've got a number of hurdles. These are difficult cases to win when you're trying to speculate as to what would have happened. We'll see what Indiana does with this. I don't think this is going to come out in favor of Safeco, though. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you. It's a difficult, difficult situation, but you can't put back in the bottle the genie, you know, and here,
or the toothpaste.
Right. It wasn't preserved, and so yeah, I think Safeco, should have some remedy, but I don't know how you get to that. So I just don't know how.
That's right. So with that brings us to no BI. no BI, no GIPA, no BIPA, no any other strange abbreviations of things that seem to occupy our time. Our prediction sure to go wrong. We meant to do these last week and they didn't happen, but we're going to do them this week because there were no other cases this week that we discussed. Not a very busy week for the courts, as you can imagine. The opinions we've, or the arguments we talked about are from the second week of December. So, and we've got, there were a lot of arguments. So we've got arguments into next week already. Our records now are 286.5, 59.5, and 19 for Dan. I am 283.5, 62.5, and 19. One of the cases that came out was Wilson versus the University of Chicago that we discussed on episode 177. This is a case where the plaintiff tried to rely on the testimony of the plaintiff's fiance that the doctor admitted he screwed up, and then rely on the doctor's testimony, the two doctors, two surgeons' testimony, who were cardiothoracic surgeons, I believe, that they had, as to the standard of care, and that they had breached it. Court said, you don't have an expert, no dice. I have one giant question in this case. Why wasn't the 622 affiant available to sign the affidavit?
I don't know.
I frankly question the existence of this doctor, given that most 622 affidavits are anonymous. I question their existence. I hate to do that, but there doesn't seem there was much changed during the course of the discovery that wasn't known at the beginning of this case. They knew what they were claiming caused the injury. This is a known complication that they were trying to thread a needle through the septum of this person's heart that had not been stopped. I mean, goodness gracious. And they're using this they're doing this through imaging, and they punctured the outer wall of the left ventricle. Needless to say, that was a known complication that can occur in the absence of negligence. This is not a res ipsa case because it could occur in the absence of negligence. And the doctors said it could occur in the absence of negligence. So they'd have to get someone to say that it couldn't have occurred in the absence of negligence. And that presumably was what the 622 said. So why couldn't the doctor say that when it came time to put up or shut up on the summary judgment? He would sign the 622 anonymously, but not later on? I don't know. I have my doubts. Maybe the person existed. I don't know. I question why he signed the 622 in the first instance if he wasn't going to put his name publicly. Right. I've always had grave concerns about allowing people to sign affidavits anonymously to allow on these affidavits of merit. Not because they're fake, just because you should put your name to it. If you're going to say that somebody did something, committed professional malpractice, you should put your name to it and have to stand up and be counted that that's what you're alleging. And that it can be done anonymously, sure, it makes it easier to file the lawsuit. But, you know, where was he when the time came? Did he just chicken out? I kind of doubt that.
Which doesn't usually happen.
Maybe he did.
Who knows?
Right. I don't know.
Or changed the view, right?
Maybe.
Who knows?
I can't imagine that he was surprised to find out that the doctors he was accusing of negligence said they didn't do it. To quote the judge from My Cousin Vinny, so you want to suspend all of the rules of Alabama procedure because you find yourself in the unique position of have a client who said he didn't do it. He was surprised to find out the doctor said they didn't do it. Not many doctors say that they did.
Right.
And there was a dispute over whether that was the thing in this case, is that he said that he did. We were relying upon the statement you knew he was going to say he didn't make. Come on. I'm very, very skeptical of this situation. So we got that one right. Then the next one we got right was Mrazek versus Walmart, which we talked about on episode 181. And I mentioned in passing in my column recently that kind of covered a whole bunch of premises liability cases. Dan, why don't you tell us about the Walmart case?
Sure. This was the case where the lady went to Walmart and claimed that there was a wall shelf bottom
end cap
that was different than the others. She no rip in her pants, no apparent injury on her leg. She went around the store and videotaped a number of other end caps to show that this one was different. And so the court affirmed a finding that she was not able to establish that this was a defective product or that somehow Walmart was responsible for this end cap. So pretty quick decision on that. We covered it in 181, and here we are today. So
very good. So our prediction sure to go wrong this week, Dan. We've got
Attain.
I'm drawing a blank. The Attain versus Watson. This is going to get affirmed.
Affirmed.
And Great American versus State Farm is going to get affirmed.
Affirmed. Yep.
And Safeco versus Blue Sky. That's going to get affirmed.
I think so. Yep.
That is that the trial court is going to get affirmed.
Yep.
And which is the only opinion that exists now, because as we talked about, the circuit or the appellate court opinion is vacated. So with that, that brings us to our rule of the week. We gave Corey Webster a week off. Dan found someone else to give us a rule of the week. Frank Ramos down in Florida. Dan, don't you tell us about this bizarre situation.
Yeah, Winston and Strawn filed a motion and was sued by a boutique law firm for allegedly violating copyright protections for the filing itself. And we'll see what this is. A lot of discussion on this matter on Frank's post and otherwise with respect to whether this has any merit. I don't think anybody really contemplated. I don't know about you, Pat, but I've never even, I know in the insurance context a lot of copywriting takes place, but I never even contemplated copywriting any filing I've ever made in my life or any motion. You know,
I'd be flattered. I've had it happen.
Yeah.
I filed a brief in a case and someone copies and pastes it, changes the names and slaps it. I go, great.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Yeah. They admire my work. Right. And I've had judges, you know, follow and take my motions and put them into their order. And so I guess now
my first appeal that I handled as a young lawyer, they basically copied and pasted my brief of a appellee and turned it into the opinion.
Yeah.
Yes. That great.
Yeah.
It was the clerk, I made the clerk's life very easy. I was very proud of myself.
Yeah. And so this may not be a rule of the week, but it's one to watch just because it seems, I think many in the legal industry were surprised by this. And, you know, as you said, it's usually flattery and, you know, on some stuff, I mean, the reality is, you know, most of summary judgment and the rules and stuff, a lot of there's seminal cases, the other insurance provisions we've talked about, there's only so many ways you can argue some of these things to begin with, you know, under certain rules, Supreme Court rules, there's limited amounts of cases that are on point. And so you cite to those, right? You know, the rule is, and, you know, my arbitrations, I often get, you know, the contract law in Illinois is whatever, and it's this, you know, they cite to the same case that stands for the proposition. So, you know, it's it'll be an interesting thing to watch as it develops and see if this has any legs on it.
Yeah, it's very common to go into the archives or go into the dockets. These are public records.
Yep.
And go in and grab what someone else did and say, "Hey, I'll steal that."
Yeah.
I think this may be a publicity stunt as much as anything.
It could be.
I imagine if the law firm that copied it was Dewey, Cheatham & Howe instead of Winston and Strawn, they may not have filed it.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, Winston, a lawyer from Winston did this is, and by this, I'm not saying the lawyer did anything wrong.
No.
How they billed for it, that may be a different question.
Right.
But
and that's a whole other issue, right?
That's between them and their client.
Right.
That has nothing to do with the copyright issue. But the idea that you could copyright such a thing, and we saw some commentary that said the cases they were relying on that said that this was copyrighted and you couldn't do it. It's pretty big stretches.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to be that the law, at least in the blog that I saw explaining this, casts a real doubt on whether this claim has merit, which leads me to believe that this was it's a nice publicity stunt.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what's going on here. Who knows?
Who knows?
But, you know, keep copying other people's stuff. I think it'll be okay.
And
so
the only other thing it could be is a potential business development ploy, right? Is look at us, you know, big firms are using our stuff, come to us for your needs. Who knows?
And we'll do it cheaper. Yep. We'll do it cheaper, faster, better.
Right.
So, and by the copying, I mean the copying of the stuff that isn't copyrighted. Right. I don't think you can copyright a brief that's filed in the public record. That seems a bit ridiculous.
It does. Indeed.
So with that, we'll take our leave and we'll see you next week on the Podium and Paddle podcast. Happy New Year, everybody.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.